The Voyage of Odysseus by Glyn Iliff, read by Charles Armstrong for Saga Egmont. The Voyage of Odysseus by Glyn Iliff. Book 1. Chapter 1. Dedicating the Anchor Stones. Eperitus, son of Aphidas, looked across the Scamander Valley at the ruins of Troy. Countless fires pumped slanted pillars of smoke high into the sky, where they congregated and drifted west to befog the late afternoon sun. The walls of the great city, which had stood for so long in defiance against the besieging Greeks, were now broken and charred. The once impenetrable gates stretched out in the dust like slain giants. From his viewpoint on the ridge, Eperitus could see the destruction within. The hovels of the lower city still burning the best part of a day after the first torches had set them alight. The mansions and temples of the citadel, Pergamos, blackened and roofless as the fires gorged themselves on the delicate furniture and rich tapestries that had filled the halls of Troy's elite. King Priam's palace had borne the brunt of the Greeks' vengeance. One whole wing had exploded when the flames had reached the giant Pithoi of oil and wine, blowing out the walls and killing Greek and Trojan without discrimination. Not satisfied with that, King Agamemnon had ordered his soldiers to tear down the walls of his enemy's home stone by stone, so that all that remained now was a pile of scorched rubble. Before it, in the centre of the courtyard, a huge pyre fed on the corpses of the fallen. There were other such pyres throughout the ruined city, for despite their hatred of the Trojans, the Greeks would not abandon their bodies to be feasted on by dogs and vultures, leaving their spirits to remain on earth instead of being led down to the halls of Hades. 10 years of war had made savages out of the Greeks, but they were not yet monsters. Halfway between the Scaean Gate and the walls of the citadel, wreathed in smoke, stood the great horse that had brought death and destruction to Troy. Had it only been last night, Eperitus thought, that he had sat hidden inside its wooden body with the best of the Greeks, waiting for the moment to leap out and wreak chaos on the unsuspecting Trojans. It had been a fearful gamble, the idea of his friend and king, the ever-resourceful Odysseus, but after 10 years of deadlock, the Greeks had been willing to risk anything to end the war. And by the will of the gods, they had succeeded. In one terrible night, Troy had fallen. Men, women, and children were slaughtered in their sleep or chased from their homes and hunted down like swine until the streets ran with their blood. Only the females were shown any mercy, if rape and the murder of their families could be considered merciful. They were useful slaves, an essential part of any economy, but were a poor recompense for 10 years of war. With Troy's wealth exhausted, the only men who had gained from the conflict were the sons of Atreus. Menelaus had recovered his wife, the incomparable Helen, from the clutches of the Trojans, while Agamemnon, the most powerful of all the Greek rulers, had destroyed his greatest rival and ensured the Aegean trade routes would belong to Mycenae. As for the rest of the kings, their rewards were less tangible. Freedom from the oaths that had bound them to the war until Troy was defeated or death had claimed them, and immortality through their illustrious deeds, the aspiration of every fighting man. Though Eperitus doubted whether any thought the price they had paid was worth it. For his own part, he knew it had been too much. He'd started the war seeking glory in battle, and his lust had been well satisfied, glutted even to the point of sickness, in a 10-year orgy of blood and death. He'd also been keen for revenge against his treacherous father, the kingslayer who had sought refuge among the Trojans. That desire, too, had been met, though he'd felt little satisfaction in seeing Aphidas take his own life. And the price of glory and vengeance had been the lives of his daughter, his squire, and countless comrades in arms. But there was one compensation for all that he had suffered in the bloody decade-long conflict.
"What are you thinking?"
A soft hand slipped into his, and he turned to see Astynomy beside him. Her cheeks were smeared with dirt to conceal their softness, while the leather breastplate and long woolen cloak she wore hid her womanly curves from unwelcome eyes. Only the tresses of her black hair, tied into a messy bun at the back of her head, betrayed her true sex.
"Come on, tell me what's on your mind,"
she insisted with a smile, her Trojan accent broad and exotic to Eperitus's ears. She reached up with her other hand and ran her...